You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast, episode 20.
Hi, it's Jo here. And just before we get onto the show, I want to let you know that the doors to my Mojo membership are now open, a place where you get to hunt down your mojo and keep it so that you can earn more, achieve more and live more. Head over to my Instagram profile, jobritton.mojo, and check out the Mojo membership link in my bio. And now on to the main part of the show. You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with me, your host, Jo Britton. Your mojo is your energy, your enthusiasm, and your motivation so that you've got the ability to get results for your personal and professional life without freaking out and burning out. Tune in for practical advice on how to find your mojo and keep it. Welcome back to another episode of Mojo Matters. I can't tell you how excited I am for today's guest. She is one of my heroes and is healing the world, one mind and nervous system at a time. My guest today is the incredible Lisa Wimberger, founder of the Neurosculpting Institute and author of several books, including New Brain, New Beliefs, New Brain, Neurosculpting, a Whole Brain Approach to Healing Trauma, and a kid's book too, which actually Lisa also says is for adults. The Monster Under Your Bed is just a story in your head. I have that book too, Lisa. And the reason this is such a special interview for me to do is because I'm honoured to have been trained and mentored by Lisa in the practice of neurosculpting at the Neurosculpting Institute in Colorado last year. And this is a biggie because it now means that neurosculpting is a real first in the UK, as I became the UK's first and only neurosculpting facilitator. And the reason I wanted to bring this life transforming practice to the UK is because I've experienced firsthand the massive benefits of it. And right now, as we navigate the most challenging of times, I'm seeing levels of fear, stress, anxiety, frustration at a whole new level. And neurosculpting is a gift that the UK needs, because for me, the practice got me out of a massive spiral of anxiety, overwhelm and stress and fear, especially during this pandemic. And also, when the only support at the time that was available was through the GP, and it was anxiety medication. And whilst I'm not at all knocking that, I know for me, I've been on and off that medication for many years. And for me, it was only treating my symptoms. So it gave me a bit of a boost. But when I came off it, I went back to the way I was. And I just thought there had to be another way. And there was for me, and it was neurosculpting. And it's helped me to release some of their beliefs and stories that I've carried for years that haven't served me well, that have sabotaged my progress, that have informed my behavior, my actions, and consequently the results that I've got, the beliefs that I'm not good enough, that I'm a failure. So in today's episode, I'm so happy to have Lisa with us. We're going to be covering a lot of ground and hopefully geeking out on the brain science as well, because that's something I'm so fascinated by and always aim to bring to my coaching practice as well. So Lisa's going to share her own story and how this led her to researching the neuroscience and the practice of self-directed neuroplasticity to create this truly unique practice of neurosculpting, which she's used to heal herself from a trauma that you will have to hear to believe, and how she's since been using neurosculpting to help so many people, from police officers to leaders in organizations, to release the grip of stress and negative thought patterns. And this, I think, is really massively important to the world of work, because we're bringing these patterns and stories to our roles, and it affects how we show up and how we respond and how we lead. So we're going to be exploring how and why the brain makes these patterns and scripts, and how we access them, and how these scripts determine the way that we navigate and respond to day-to-day life, and what neurosculpting is and how it can help you change those scripts and patterns that aren't helpful to you. So Lisa, it is such an honour to have you. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. I'm so proud that you are the first in the UK. I remember when we were dialoguing over email before you went into certification and how exciting it was for both of us that, you know, the UK was going to finally get neurosculpting. And I have to say, since you've been certified, I have one or two wanting to jump in right behind you, but they haven't yet. You're still the only one. Yeah, it's great to be here on your podcast. I'm so excited.
That's amazing. So could you start maybe by sharing your story? Because it starts with you getting struck by lightning, doesn't it, when you were young, and then...
Yes, it sounds like it's all a big fairy tale or crazy made up story, but it's real. And sometimes I have to remind myself that's really my life. So, you know, I was a very quiet, passive child and dealt with stress in a way that was very calm, inward, frozen sort of, you know, stress pattern. And that was fine, except for when I turned 15 on my birthday, I was hit by lightning in the base of the spine. It had hit the side of a house that I was leaning against during a crazy rainstorm, and it came out through the base of my spine, and I was thrown from the house, and the boy standing next to me also was thrown from the house. We were standing shoulder to shoulder and we were wet from it being rainy. And I didn't really believe it had happened. I didn't understand what was going on. My friends were all in shock. They were screaming that we were hit. We flew through the air. I was in a lot of pain, but I was conscious. I was alive. So surely this could not have been lightning. But later that week, I started having my first blackouts, which progressed over the years to become very extreme grand mal seizures that over a long period of undiagnosed, mysterious seizures, I was finally given the diagnosis that I was vasovagal to an extreme degree. I didn't know what those words meant. I didn't know what my vagus nerve was. All I knew is that for 25 years, I had been having these terrible seizures a few times a year that would take me out. Not epileptic seizures and not a phasing kind of seizure, but the kind where, you know, you'd feel this strange little aura, this drop of the stomach, and then the world would disappear. And what would be happening in my body is that I would be going rigid. My heart rate would drop rapidly, sometimes to completely stopping. My brain would shut off through the reticular activating system because there was no oxygen going to the brain. I would go rigid. Eyes wide open, facial expression frozen. I would go into cyanosis, which is when you start turning blue. And I would be, you know, completely frozen. And usually in the beginning, you recalibrate from me and your heart will start back up again. If it hasn't stopped, usually it's just very, very low. But in my case, it had stopped multiple times. It will recalibrate after a short time, and you'll start to oxygenate, you'll start to become conscious, and in theory, you're fine. But the worse these get, and I learned this through studying Stephen Porges' work, the worse these get, the more your body entrains to doing them better, right? The more I have them, the more efficient my body wants to make them, thinking they must be important if I keep having them. And so you get better and better at this kind of vasovagal seizure response, which is ultimately the play dead response. So long story short, my natural disposition to freeze and go quiet during stress was exacerbated during that traumatic episode physically through the lightning, emotionally through a traumatic episode, lack of knowledge, lack of practices, lack of information, and I had no capacity to stop these. Got my diagnosis in my early 30s after having them from age 15. And they said, you're not epileptic, because, I mean, I never thought I was, but they tested me in the hospital. And I didn't have epilepsy patterns in my cortex, normal EEGs, normal EKGs. And so they said, you're vasovagal, and there's nothing to do about it. And that made zero sense to me, because here's why I got my diagnosis. I was in a gynecological exam. I was about 30. And I felt like I was going to faint, which was very familiar to me. And I said I was going to faint. And the gynecologist said, no problem, just lay back. And what I woke up to was him about to inject me into the heart with atropine. He had a loaded needle of atropine about to inject me. Atropine is used to resuscitate. And he was shaking. I don't know how long I was out. It was standard for me to do this. He said, I flatlined. He said, I had a grand mal seizure and you flatlined and we couldn't get your pulse. We couldn't get you breathing. And we were about to resuscitate you. And he said, has this happened before? And that's when it hit me. I said, well, you know, I've been blacking out like this since I was 15. He said, you're not blacking out. You're seizing and you're flatlining, which started to put pieces together that had never occurred to me before. It started to make sense of why recovery was so painful. I'd wake up from these moments, and if they were just fainting, it should have been easy to wake up, but it never was. It was excruciating pain. It was pins and needles through my whole body. It was inability to hold my bowels or my urine, you know, the inability to move without vomiting, no motor control, no ability or energy to move my muscles. It was a very difficult recovery, and it started getting more and more difficult in my 20s to recover. By the time I was in my 30s, obviously recovery was potentially needing to be injected with atropine. And I remember after I came to, I couldn't speak or move for 3 to 4 hours. I was laying on the table in the gynecological exam room and they couldn't move me. And now they're starting to worry because now the day is expiring and the clinic's going to close and I can't move. And at the time, not sure why they didn't send me to the ER that time. I did go to the ER multiple other times. I'm not sure why they didn't send me, other than the fact that at the time it was a low income clinic. I was a cash paying low income client. I don't want to blame systemic anything, but I don't think I was in line for that kind of treatment, knowing that I was going to pay cash for it. So I think they were trying to minimize potential impact to me and to them as a clinic for having a patient practically die during a gynecological exam. So I don't know, there could be lots of reasons around that, but it was the gift I had been waiting for. I had never had that happen in to that extreme in front of a doctor. I had seized in front of doctors in the past when I was a teenager, but they told my mother I was hormonal.
Really?
When I was 17, I was taken to the doctor for this. My parents knew. They hadn't seen me have an episode, but I had told them. So they took me to the doctor, said, my daughter's fainting. They drew blood. I actually seized in that office at 17. And they told me that I was hormonal and possibly this was because of puberty. That was a waste of time. So this doctor gave me the gift of naming this thing for me. But what he did also was he gave me the key. He said, This is likely induced by stress.
Really?
And I don't know why he said it. I don't know if he had been schooled. That wasn't a common thing, I think, for doctors to say. They usually try to find the reason. But he said these things usually happen from stress. And all these light bulbs went off. And the journey started there. Really, the journey for neurosculpting started right there for me.
And so you were saying earlier that it was like, this is what it is, but it's almost like tough. This is what it is. We can't do anything about it. So how did that set you on the path then? Because you started to research a lot in terms of the body and the neuroscience and what was going on. And
well, he said the magic word. He said, this is induced by stress. And I had grown up as a meditator. Clearly not using meditation the way it would have benefited my body, which is a whole other dialogue we can have. But so my whole background was trying to understand emotional, spiritual healing. I had never put it in the stress lens, through the stress lens before. Yeah. But when he said this is stress induced, I thought, well, wait a minute. I have access to meditation practices that I have been taught my whole life. I've been taught by monks. I've been taught by metaphysicians. I've been self-taught. Like, I have a lot of this under my belt. Shouldn't that help? So when he said the word stress, and then he said, there's nothing you can do about it, my brain called BS on the whole thing. My brain said, yeah. Oh, wait a minute. No. Had you said this is a genetic disorder, I would have believed there was nothing you can do about it. But because you said this was a something potentially controllable, you better believe I'm going to do something about it. So he said the two magic things I needed to hear. He gave me a name for the thing, and then he gave me a cause.
Yeah.
Which had been invisible to me up to that point. So that's when I said, oh, he gave me something else too. He said, there's nothing you can do about it. And that is a challenge to me. I grew up rising to overcome anyone who told me I couldn't do something.
Love it.
So he didn't realize it was all his delivery. Had any other doctor said it any other way, I don't know if I would have believed I could heal myself. But he was what I needed in that moment. And so I said, okay, well, he said vasovagal. I don't know what that means. Let me go research it. So this started me down the road of walking away from the metaphysical studies and moving towards, I need to understand my body, my nervous system, and neuroscience and neurophysiology is probably the best place to start because I have clues and now I need to go find out what to do about these clues. And so that started me down a very self-serving road of neuroscience classes, certifications. I had zero interest in getting a degree. In fact, I wasn't even taking my classes all at the same school. I was taking whatever class I could online. A couple were in person, but most of them were online through any university that had free courses or courses I could afford. And all of it was for me to figure out, what is vasovagal syncope? How do I influence my neurophysiology? What can I do to understand neuroplastic engagement so that I can now have agency over my inner landscape? Like, I just made my own curriculum and found it and got the information I needed and then pieced together. I sort of backwards engineered my meditation practice because clearly I wasn't using it correctly. Because what I learned was it's missing a whole bunch of pieces. Mm-hmm. And my brain, my nervous system needed a bunch of safety checks and balances put in place for it to even be willing to use and learn a different pattern. Because the pattern I was engaging in was self-protective patterns over self-protective patterns in response to overwhelming stress. However, my definition of overwhelming stress was very, very all-encompassing. So a day in a normal life of somebody might have been defined by my nervous system as overwhelming stress.
Yeah.
So I had to really understand my perceptions, the neurophysiology behind how perceptions, beliefs, and patterns talk to the body, why my body was choosing this response over a more healthy oxygenating response, like getting angry is a much more physiologically sustainable response than freezing. And I didn't understand any of it. Neuroscience answered every question I ever had about who I was as a being in a body. And I thought, there are keys here. So I used what I was learning and created a new kind of structure for that felt like meditation to me. It also felt like hypnosis to me. It felt like shamanic journeying. It felt like a lot of things that were in my life's experience up to that point. And I'm sure I took from all of those things, but none of them had this five-step structure. And I put the five-step structure in place because science was telling me this is the way my body and mind need to hear things and experience things in order to be receptive to change. And I said, this is worth a shot. The seizures were terrible at that point. I landed in the hospital multiple times. I flatlined in front of my three-year-old daughter in a food court, and that caused ongoing damage. I mean, she's 16, she's gonna be 17. And we are still dealing with the very subtle patterns that have come from her witnessing me flatline and being resuscitated by paramedics at a very key age of understanding safety in the world. And then the last seizure I ever had, I was done. I mean, if my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, wasn't there, I would be dead because I could not recalibrate to breathing on my own in that one. And he and his friends had to keep me breathing, reminding me to breathe because I just kept exiting. And that's when I took the neuroscience I was learning, this five-step structure I thought might work. And I said, I have no other choice. So desperation is the mother of invention. Mm. And put the five steps in place. And I started using that as my meditation practice, started practicing and rehearsing inside those five steps, new responses that I was hoping my body would pay attention to and learn, kind of like I was an actress on a stage rehearsing a new way to be. And I had no idea if it would work. And I practiced and I did this every day, hoping and praying that the next seizure would be manageable or I could circumvent it or I was going to die. Mm. That's where my brain was. And it happened about 8 months later after the seizure where I couldn't breathe on my own. I felt another one coming. It was in the car. And I thought, I am surely dead at this point. And this rehearsal thing that I had been playing with for 8 months, this scene I had been playing out in my mind, hoping my body would believe it. The scene was that I was victorious over this seizure, right? I was rehearsing this. And it actually played out in the car where instead of seizing, my body started engaging the script I had been rehearsing for 8 months. And instead of seizing, I got extremely violent, which, as you know from studying the nervous system, anger and outward arousal is way more sustainable for the brain than freeze, which stops you breathing, right? So I was thrilled that I was having a volatile, violent response instead of seizing. And then my nervous system started shaking. My whole body started shaking for hours. And I didn't even know anything about neurogenic tremoring at that point. I just knew my body needed to do this, and I let it, and my boyfriend let it happen. And when I was done shaking for hours, I knew everything inside me felt different. My seizures felt gone. I had never had that feeling before. I'd always had the feeling that these could come at any moment. And this was this knowing in my bones, they're gone. And I never had another one again.
Ah.
And I knew I was never going to have another one again. So at that point I said, okay, creator, you just gave me a second chance. I won't take this for granted. I am now married to this work and sharing it with people. And I don't care what it looks like or what, whether it brings me money or not. I just, if I don't share this, I really felt if I didn't share it, I was going to die because I was like ignoring the gift I got. And I thought it would be really bad karma not to consecrate myself to this practice.
Yeah.
And that's how it all started.
It's amazing. It's incredible. So we've got really neurosculpting, correct me if I'm wrong, is this union of the meditation practice with the neuroscience and the fact that it's self-directing in terms of the neuroplasticity in your brain and the patterns that we have that we can change and disrupt and create new ones. And that for me has been absolutely incredible. And just share with people, because you've mentioned the five-step process, how it actually works and what it does for people.
Yeah. So it's a simple sequential process that makes meditation sort of follow a bit of a script or an architecture. And the architecture is there. The steps are there because the steps really invite the brain and the nervous system to participate in the kinds of ways it needs to for you to feel safe enough inside your body to start changing patterns. Changing patterns is a threat to the nervous system. Mm-hmm. And as much as our conscious mind may want to change, the pattern that itself is going to try to protect itself. So anything designed to change it is a direct threat. And unless you know how to create all sorts of safety and induced compliance in your brain and nervous system, you're not going to change. So the steps do that. So the first step is we have to quiet the resistance center, the fight or flight center of the brain. And we do that very simply. We give it what it's looking for. We give it a chance to marinate in, oh, I'm safe right now. I have four walls around me. I'm dry. My temperature's regulated. Oh, my shirt's soft. Anything that feeds your survival brain, the idea that right now you have everything you need, that starts the process of making the nervous system feel safe. And that's step one. And we do that with certain kinds of focuses and prompts that you start to learn how to do yourself. Step two is we have to activate and recruit energy into the focused learning center of the brain that's going to now really pay attention and want to learn a new story or want to focus on making real the edits you might make to an old story. We need learning to do that. And in order to do that, we have to wake up the front of the brain. So step one, we quiet the middle. Step two, we wake up the front. And we do that very simply because the front of the brain loves novelty. So we think of ridiculous novel thoughts and we get a little activity going in the front of the brain. It's super easy. And those two things together in that sequencing create a really beautifully induced brain state. A brain that's safe, a brain that's paying attention and listening. So that's a state of rest and attention, which is the only place self-directed neuroplasticity happens in your best interest. It can happen subconsciously and you'll just be reinforcing all your old patterns. So rest and attention simultaneously is a magical place. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Andrew Huberman talks about that state of neuroplastic occurrence. And we get there by inducing the brain to be there. Then once we're there, we go through steps 3, 4, and 5, which is, what do we want to shift? What old pattern would we like to rehearse differently so it's better for us? Or what new pattern would we like to play out creatively in the mind so that our rested yet focused brain is participating. And that story is done in a way that you learn, either you get guided by someone like you, Joe, to someone you're working with, or you learn how to guide yourself to make sure both sides of the brain are involved in the story time. Left and right hemisphere must be involved. And that is called bilateral stimulation. And the reason that's super helpful is because it boosts the way the brain perceives it's supposed to pay attention. The brain is perceiving, wow, you're using more of me, left and right side alternating back and forth. I guess this is important right now, right? So it's real estate. Real estate matters in the brain. The more real estate you recruit, the more important a moment becomes. But it does something else, this interesting bilateral thing that's happening in step three. It creates more safety, because any trauma, stress pattern we have is going to be lateralized in some way. It will either be more right brain dominant or more left brain. And we don't know which, but what we do know about stress and trauma is that it is created in a lateralized way. And Bessel van der Kolk talks about this in his work, in his book, The Body Keeps the Score. A lot of traumatized people with PTSD tend to be during the trauma, like flashbacks, they will be right hemisphere lateralized. And this is also emerging understanding in the work with anxiety as well. So we know the old pattern lateralizes us. Well, Einstein said, you can't solve a problem by this in the same energy that you used to create it. So we can't stay lateralized when we're trying to change a pattern. We have to kind of push ourselves to bilaterally contribute, breaking the lateralized pattern. So step three, even though it sounds very heady and complicated the way I'm describing it, step three is a fun story. It's the rehearsal script, and you color that rehearsal script creatively with things that your left brain likes to think about and things that your right brain likes to think about. Words, spelling, details, lists all get the left brain very excited and engaged. Colors, abstract symbols, textures all get the right brain very engaged. So in the storytelling, in the rehearsal part of the meditation, you're using imagery of colors and textures and words, and you're spelling things, and you're doing all the things that help you naturally, effortlessly, playfully cross the midline of the brain. This is very, very different than any meditation form I've ever learned. You're induced in steps one and two. You are bilaterally stimulating in step three. I do believe EMDR uses bilateral stimulation as a core approach to healing, which it works. So then we use a bilateral engagement as well in step three. And in steps four and five, we give the meditator an opportunity to create little references, physical memories, physical references to the meditation experience so that they can reactivate those physical things the next day and subtly remember their meditation. Things like a hand gesture, things like maybe smelling an essential oil at a key part of the meditation to sort of let that scent remind them in the future of the meditation. Words, very cognitive behavioral conditioning kind of moments in step four and five. So what I had to create, I had to pull the best of everything that worked, right? Induction through hypnosis is extremely powerful. This is why hypnosis is so wonderful. And I have a basic autogenic hypnosis experience in my background. So I was like, okay, I need an induction. I need safety. That bilateral stimulation, neuroscience was telling me that was a must. steps 4 and 5, the cognitive behavioral stuff, that was all coming through my studies of Hebb's law of neuroplasticity, right? Like you can link sensation, perception, and experience together as long as it's all happening simultaneously. So I put all of this stuff together and came up with the sequencing of these 5 steps. And again, going back to, I didn't know if this would work. I had my fingers crossed. I had desperation as my main fuel. And I had a lot of fear around, would I leave my daughter without a mother? And that was enough for me to invest in my gut telling me these 5 steps are going to do something for you. In that sequencing, I had never learned it anywhere else, but I tried it and it worked. And those are the 5 steps, and they're easy, and they're done in a 15-minute, 20-minute meditation, and they're playful and creative, and it doesn't even have to be taken so seriously, and it still works.
It does. Why I find this incredible is, having tried meditation, and for me, I'm not a patient person, I struggled with meditation, and then I would beat myself up because I can't meditate and undo the good of it. And I'm also one for the science. So I always look for the science and things that are grounded in science. And this, to me, it just combines all the best of both worlds, doesn't it? And like you say, it's really fun, and it's kind of 15 or 20 minutes. And also for me, the stories that I've carried, I didn't even know I had them, to be fair, but I was reacting to the world in moments rather than being able to respond in ways that were helpful to me. So in the world of work, something would happen and I'd get prickly with it, and then I'd feel myself get emotionally angry or frustrated. And then I'd get annoyed with myself that that was my reaction. And then I would probably was rehearsing that pattern, and it was getting stronger. And those are the sorts of things then I would feel really bad about myself, you know, and then I've crafted a story that I'm not good enough to do this. And it's all of that stuff. And then that holds you back. And incredibly within, oh, it has to be like one 20 minute neurosculpting meditation. For me, I released so much of that unhelpful story, but also in another 20 minute meditation, it created this is possible, you know, I'm confident I can do this stuff. And once I've had those beliefs and stories aligned to the things that I want to achieve, the progress has been incredible. And this is what I want to be able to bring to, also to my coaching practice and working with people who want to achieve actually what they deserve to achieve. And it's all thanks to you and 20 minutes. I mean, I say only 20 minutes. I mean, it's years of your work, isn't it? It's so many years. But also, because you have, there are so many applications to this when, you know, the more I was learning from you and you were telling stories. So you've used this a lot in law enforcement, haven't you? And leaders in organizations. Tell us a little bit about that and how you apply neurosculpting in those situations.
Yeah, I will. But first I want to, you brought up an idea that I just wanted to share. You said you worked on stories you didn't even know you had, to be fair. Here's the interesting thing. The moment you start creating safety for the nervous system and small, manageable, gentle, safe change, the nervous system starts to trust you. And then it will tell you so much of what you need to know, so much of what it had to mask before. Because if it told you before, if it revealed those stories before, and you had no way to make it safe, those stories would then create more harm. So our nervous system will mask the things we cannot process. Mm. And we'll just still feel the result of them in the body and then start to wonder why do we get prickly over this thing all the time?
Yeah.
And then the mind thinks it knows, but the nervous system says, well, you haven't made it safe for me yet. So you can know all you want. I'm not going to change. So now all your knowing is going to cause you to beat yourself up because you can't change because you feel powerless now. So the gift that I found that you just articulated was that if you start to learn how to speak to your nervous system, to give it what it needs to feel safe enough to exhale, to shift, to dial down a little bit, when it starts to do that, the veil gets pulled back and you start to be able to sometimes very distinctly identify patterns. And sometimes they're still vague, but they are there and you can work on a more subtle layer and change can happen very, very quickly. And the applications for this, I had zero intention of a target audience. I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew I married this. Now I got to share it. And I don't know what to do. I thought I was going to do it in the corporate world. But I had been driving home from work shortly after I knew I was supposed to devote my life to this. And two times during the same intersection, I got a flash of a visual. I had no idea where it came from. And it was an officer putting a homeless psychotic person into the back of their patrol car. The homeless psychotic person was out of their mind. The officer was crying. And when he closed the door, there was black tar moving up his hands and his heart was starting to like calcify. I don't know where this image came from. It hit me hard at this particular intersection, hit me twice in that same week. And I thought, oh, I guess I'm supposed to take this work to officers who don't know how to regulate emotionally, who don't know maybe how to deal with the on-the-job stress, and ultimately, who might not know they have biases that are creating more harm than good, right? Which we see in the world so clearly today. So that vision caused me to reach out to my first law enforcement agency back in 2007. So I had this strange entry point where I started bringing neurosculpting first to law enforcement and managed through my own tenacity to become a consultant for 6 or 7 different agencies in Colorado and then agencies on the East Coast of the United States and in some of the Midwestern states. And then I was speaking at these international law enforcement conferences. And now I had private clients who were international officers from like Israeli military or American military and CIA, and people from the FBI were in my audiences. And I'm running them through these neurosculpting meditations. And some of them are having such profound breakthroughs that they have to leave the room and come back later and talk to me privately and say, I didn't know I was going to have all that come up. I didn't know that was all in there. And so that was my first audience. From there, the clientele started just coming from all different places. So we ended up having amazing effect with spinal cord injuries. So we've got some quadriplegics who have moved again with neurosculpting. The patterns, the paralysis patterns, some of those can be shifted. And I didn't know that until we shifted them. And I've gotten quadriplegics to move their fingers and their toes again. Chronic pain clients, clients of Lyme and mold exposure who have all sorts of comorbidities that rack the nervous system, OCD cutters, people who are suicidal. Now, none of neurosculpting is therapy. It is not positioned as therapy. It's positioned as a way to help regulate your nervous system and unlock from the repetitious stress patterns. And what I've discovered over the last 15 years is that that helps all human beings. And so that's why the clientele in the student body is so diverse, because even though there's no one size fits all, there is one common denominator of all human beings, is that our mammalian nervous system needs regulation for the long-term health of the organism. And that will support, to the best of its capacity, healing things that are normally exacerbated by an unregulated nervous system. Yeah. And an unregulated nervous system exacerbates all disease. So it's this wild experiment that I've seen play out in front of me, that people of all walks of life, of all mental, emotional, and physical issues come, and so many of them benefit from this. I'm not saying this heals things. I'm not saying this cures spinal cord injury. But what I'm saying is, just like you, Joe, did not know the stories that were there, every single one of us listening right now does not know the full extent of the patterns that drive us.
Yeah.
And getting a peek at those with safety and a way to regulate around those offers us a superpower of potential healing that has blown my mind consistently still to this day around what it heals in me and what it supports in other people.
I know, it's totally amazing, because it's really made me think, having learned from you and learned the practice, that we're so unique as individuals showing up every single day in the world and navigating and responding or reacting to the world, that unless we take agency over ourselves, you know, we're not going to be able to live our best lives, are we? And we're going to feel stuck or not healthy. So it's absolutely amazing. Lisa, it's been fabulous to talk to you. You really are truly one of my heroes. So thank you so much for joining me today.
And yes,
if people want to connect with you, how do they find you?
They can email info@neurosculptinginstitute.com. You can find Neurosculpting on Instagram. That's a great place to connect. Neurosculpting Institute on Facebook. We just went live with the NeuroPraxis app in the App Store, which is a very specific library, 60 or so specific neurosculpting meditation journeys specific to someone healing from the comorbidities of things like Lyme and mold and chronic stress. So it's super supportive. It came from really the work I did with a lot of my clients. That is now live in the App Store, super affordable. So those are all the ways. And then of course, if you, you know, want a private practitioner, you've got Joe.
Yes, you've got me. Yes. UK, that is brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's been amazing. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Such a pleasure. So excited.
You've been listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with Joe Britton. Tune in again for more practical advice on how to find your mojo and how to keep it.